This edition of Culture was first broadcast on the 2nd of April 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 25th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Today's all about iconic British art, as we explore the impact Damien Hirst has had on the art market ahead of his Tate Modern retrospective opening in London this week. I'll be joined in studio by Christina Ruiz, editor-at-large for the Art newspaper.
Here you had an artist who was in love with the press and an ad man who, you know, built a career on glib one-liners. And the early art is like a visual one-liner.
We'll also be talking to iconic British artist Sir Peter Blake about his career, old and new, and asking the grandfather of British pop art what he thinks of young Damien.
I think Damien adds an enormous amount to the colour and the excitement of the art world. And I think the mistake that people make is thinking he's a greedy young man. You know, it's about making money, whereas the point is that the subject matter is money.
We'll also look at Russian rock music through the prism of a brand new rockumentary.
The music and the show he produced is something very, very important for him. And then we realized that if we really would like to tell people about his personality, we need to talk through his songs.
That's here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. But before we turn our attentions to the art world, we're going to be playing a track or two from our CD of the week. This is Bahamas by Bahamas. They're new from Jack Johnson's Brushfire Records. And this is Caught Me Thinking. Like that? That's Caught Me Thinking, new from Bahamas. And now it's Damien Hirst time. This week, Tate Modern reserves the lion's share of its modernist caverns to the most famous artist in the world, a great British export worth an estimated £350 million, a pickler of sharks and sheep, a zapper of flies, a confounder of opinion, and an enfant terrible with grey hair and a sensitive, God-fearing soul. Maybe. To discuss the legacy so far of Damien Hirst, the artist and cash cow, I'm delighted to be joined in the studio by Christina Ruiz, editor-at-large of the Art newspaper. Christina, we're going to talk about Damien Hirst, and his show opens tomorrow at Tate Modern in London. And it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because everybody seems to be talking about the market, and everyone seems to be talking about his market legacy, when, you know, we probably know what most of the things in that show are going to be. But people talk about the money more than the art. Was that always the case with Damien Hirst?
No, it wasn't. I think Damien Hirst started off as a ball of energy and burst onto the art scene in London at a time when there wasn't much going on. And he had a huge impact in his early years, which is when he came up with most of the ideas for his work. You know, the animals in formaldehyde, the spot paintings, the spin paintings. He did most of these things quite early on, and the medicine cabinets. And then he started to make quite a lot of money. At that point, I think that he started to turn money into the subject of his work, and he's said as much. And the diamond skull that he made is obviously the best example of that, where actually bling is the very subject of the work. We actually coined a term at the Art newspaper at the time, which was bling conceptualism, because that's what it seemed to be.
And there's a lot of, I mean, the production values of these works, most famously, I guess, The Shark, The Physical Impossibility of Death in the Mind of Someone Living, was the sort of first huge artwork that had this amazing production value of his, anyway. How important do you think the production values are, the sheen of the vitrines, the quality of the sort of merchandise, in a way, and the way that they're displayed in the Saatchi's galleries and then in the White Cube Gallery, these proper white cubes? How much of it was the sort of the quality of the materials involved, do you think?
I think it was hugely important and inseparable to Damien Hirst's ambition as an artist, because when he started making art, you know, London was a very different place. And really the only places to see contemporary art were the Tate, the Saatchi Gallery, which was enormously influential at the time. It still is, but not as it was in those days. And then there were just a couple of other places, like the Anthony Doffe Gallery, where Hirst actually worked part-time while he was a student at Goldsmiths. And I think that Hirst, unlike most of his other contemporaries, just had this burning ambition to create things that he was able to imagine in his mind, the shark being an example of that. And he started sketching the shark before he had any idea how he would pay for this thing. And then he had the good fortune to encounter Charles Saatchi, who had an equal ambition and desire to astound the art world, or public at large even. You know, they were certainly aiming to create work and display, which was very controversial, and that would make headlines. Mm. You know, here you had an artist who was in love with the press and an ad man who, you know, built a career on glib one-liners. And the early art is like a visual one-liner. I mean, The Sun famously ran that headline, £50,000 for fish.
Fish no chips.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was art which was incredibly well adapted to, you know, the tabloid era.
And I want to ask you about the universal themes. Before we go on to the market stuff, we should talk about some of this amazing work, which especially in a golden period, I guess, in the late 90s and early noughties, was sort of amazing work. The titles were incredibly important. We talked about newspaper headlines, and a lot of these, the titles of the works, separate from the pieces themselves, were very evocative and quite moving. Mother and child separated, and things like the physical impossibility of death in the mind of something living channels everyone's fear of going anywhere near the sea post Jaws.
Yes,
and these are his works. Obviously, do set off. They trigger all the big fears and emotions in us, and I guess that is their success, not just the fact that he was a canny operator.
Absolutely, and he's said that he wants his titles to be very evocative, and that they should evoke, you know, different things in the viewer, which maybe are quite different from what he intended, but you do have a very strong response to that. And, you know, I remember the first time I saw The Shark, which was at the Royal Academy in Sensation, which I believe was 1997, and it was unbelievable. I mean, it was in the first, you know, the main gallery, that huge room at the centre of the Royal Academy. And it just overwhelmed the whole space. It was magnificent. I mean, there was this huge tiger shark just sitting there in the middle of the gallery. And it just looked fantastic. And I think the sort of ambition of that piece was really what struck me. The artistic ambition, you know, the production values, it just looked superb. So it was a very exciting moment. Before the money really came into his career, when he was making very creative and sincere work, I think that was Hirst at his best. And I think the Tate Show is going to focus very much on the early work. And it will be very good to see that, because we haven't seen it on display for a very long time. And it'll be, I think, really good to look back at those early works and remember actually why we were all so impressed by Hirst in the beginning.
Yeah.
Before he turned into, you know, a quite repetitive and not very interesting artist.
And how important is the idea of sincerity? People, perhaps the public perception is that he's lost some of his sincerity by knocking out skulls with diamonds on and the rest of it.
Well, I mean, I think the skull with the diamonds is a very beautiful thing to look at. I mean, undeniably, it's beautiful. And I actually think it is a great piece, because it is about, arguably, money. It is about, you know, a particular moment when he made it, which was, I think, 2007. You know, it was before the global downturn. There just seemed to be so much money swimming around the world, certainly in the art world. It's a vanitas piece in a way, you know. It's like throwing all this money at death to see if you can defy it. But obviously,
it's a sort of pharaoh's tomb or something.
Exactly.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, unfortunately, we haven't really seen anything new coming from Hirst in recent years. You know, he creates these series and then he just keeps going and going and going. When he first made The Shark, for example, it was the only one of its kind. And for 7 years, it was the only shark. And then he decided that actually he could make more sharks. So now there's an unspecified number of sharks out there. And if you wanted one, you could probably get him to make you one. You know, if you were rich enough and asked him to make you a shark or two or three, there are rumors that a French collector asked for seven.
He made them. What do you do with seven?
You put them in an art gallery.
That's quite an installation, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, because a lot of Hearst collectors today are billionaires who are building their own museums or have already built them. And it is really something that has injected a lot of money into Hearst's career, is the fact that it's become very fashionable to collect contemporary art around the world. And Hearst, better than any other living artist, has become a sort of symbol of a progressive culture. So like in the 1960s, it would be rock and roll. Today is contemporary art, and in particular, Damien Hirst. Not least because, interestingly, though he does tackle death quite a lot and God, his work is very rarely sexual. There's very little sex, almost no nudity that I can think of. So it plays quite well around the world and in more conservative cultures in the Middle East, for example, where Qatar...
Who were sponsoring the show at the Tate.
Not only are they sponsoring the show at the Tate, they're also working on their own massive Damien Hirst show for 2013.
Is this going to be a separate thing? Is this going to be the Tate
show
moving?
Completely separate.
Right.
Which is in itself interesting. So they already own quite a lot of work by Damien Hirst, some of which they bought at his Sotheby's auction in 2008 and at various other auctions as well. And, you know, Hirst, for them, is both extremely controversial in their mind, quite funky. At the same time, it's safe because... no sex, no nudity. So he's sort of winning combination,
it
really. So.
It's a funny thing. We feel the world moves east in terms of big business and all the rest of it, and the BRIC nations. And these are the ones we're talking about for the future of the art market as well.
Yes.
It's an amazing thing that the art market follows so completely the fortunes of the world, I suppose. Or is it unsurprising?
I don't think it's that surprising because actually it's, you know, galleries such as Larry Gagosian, they follow the money. And Larry Gagosian opened a branch in Hong Kong a year ago. And even though he represents a massive stable of artists, in the last year he's already had two Damien Hirst shows. And I understand that Damien Hirst is his biggest seller in Hong Kong.
How important is a big survey show, a retrospective like this one that's happening at the Tate Modern this week? How important is that to fixing prices and brewing up fresh interest in an artist like Damien Hirst, a sort of mid-career artist?
Hugely important. I mean, you cannot underestimate the importance of a Tate Modern show. And it has to be said that up until this point, Damien Hirst's backing by public institutions in this country has been very limited. Mm. He's never had a solo show in a major museum here, and very few anywhere. You know, there was one in Naples many years ago, but Naples is hardly at the center of the art world. And a lot of people have noted that, you know, that most of his backing came from private collectors and not from public institutions, you know, which I think did damage his reputation in the past. And this year, you know, you've got the conjunction of the London Olympics, Tate wanting a big blockbuster show with huge public appeal. And so it seemed to be the right time to look back at his career. I think we're going to see the best of Hirst on show at the Tate. I think they're editing out his massive output very carefully. I think there will be a focus on the early, most creative, productive years. And for example, I believe that none of the paintings that he made himself,
The Wallace Show,
are actually going to be included at all. And some series, like the reality paintings that he did, where he took pictures of his wife giving birth and then had studio assistants turn those into paintings. And, I mean, they're horrible. I don't know if you've seen them. They were really horrible. And I don't know why anybody would want to buy one of those. But they're not in the show either. So there are definitely certain bits of his output that have fallen out of favour quite spectacularly.
Hearst's market has often been described as sort of bulletproof, although we sort of said that, you know, it obviously has its ups and downs and its subtleties, and it's moving east. How does Hearst Market work in comparison to the markets of other artists, or are they all the same?
Well, the very interesting thing about Damien Hirst's market is that it actually works in almost opposite way to most other contemporary artists. So if you take a painter like John Curran, for example, who produces a very small number of canvases every year, which are very often sold before they're even finished, the small output keeps the prices and the demand really high. With Hirst, the output is so large that he's really operating more like a luxury item, you know, like a Prada handbag, than like a work of art. So the supply is near limitless. If you want a new Hirst shark or whatever, you can have it if you're willing to pay for it. So what that means is that, the luxury label, is that to make the market sustainable, it constantly needs to find new buyers in new territories.
Like a shark, it has to keep swimming or it dies.
Exactly. It has to go global. And I think that explains the Larry Gagosian spot shows. It was a global branding exercise for the artist.
So we're going to see a white cube in a Gagosian gallery on Neptune next.
Yes,
tap,
exactly.
Tap into the outer
Larry's
orbit.
Larry's already on the moon.
Indeed. Now, Hirst has been exhibited and sold all over the world, of course. So we dispatched John Haller to the Aachen Museum of Modern Art in Ischl, near Copenhagen, to meet the director, Christian Getter. Last year, the Merrier Art Foundation in London donated 8 of Hirst's works to the museum, and now they have a special Damien Hirst Hall.
I started buying Damien Hirst 10, 12 years ago. I bought a big butterfly heart, which, when I saw it, I found it deeply fascinating. This combination of this eternal symbol of love and this pink background, and then you have the butterflies which sort of drown into the paint, and you get all this symbolism of the butterfly as a symbol of the soul that flutters up to God, and all these direct communications of basic feelings which communicate directly with the observer, I think is deeply fascinating. Today I think we have 13 pieces by Damien Hirst, big pieces, very representative pieces, which all deals with these basic aspects of existence, the interpretation of life and the tragic dimension of life, which is that we're going to die eventually. And that is actually very relevant for the a museum like Aachen, which is a museum where we focus on the art that deals with the basic questions of existence. It's very sort of existentialistic dimension of the collection. It's a human being, and it's wondering about what is it all about? What is life? Why do things develop as they do? Where do we come from? What do we do here? Where do we go? All these looking for meaning in a life which seems to have lost its meaning. It's fantastic to have an artist such as Damien Hirst, who focuses on these essential aspects of life in his art. I must say that the Danish public has been extremely positive. I'm actually very, very, in a positive way, surprised that his works are so directly accepted by the Danish public. Everybody in Denmark knows that it's quite unique that we have such a fantastic collection of Damien Hirst here at Aachen. It has become a focus point among museums that you can go to Aachen and you can really get an in-depth knowledge about what Damien Hirst's art is all about.
That was Christian Getter, director of the Aachen Museum of Modern Art in Copenhagen. We also wanted to get a feel for how Hirst has gone down internationally, especially in that art world shark pool, New York City. So we dispatched Barrett Austin to meet art critic and Columbia University professor Arthur Danto.
Damien Hirst was very fortunate to gather the attention of important collectors while studying art at Goldsmiths College. I wonder what it was about Hirst that attracted the attention of collectors like Charles Saatchi in the late 1980s.
he was certainly a leader right off the bat. Just a mere student, he was able to recast the entire structure of what it is to be an art student, to be an artist already. And if you're not able to make a exhibitable work already, then there's probably not much hope for you.
And judging from a commercial perspective, Damien Hirst is perhaps the most significant living artist. He was able to mount his own show at Sotheby's without the help of his dealers, where he sold relatively recent works for $200 million. He's perhaps most well-remembered for his work For the Love of God, a human skull encrusted in diamonds, which he sold for $100 million. What do you think it is about Damien Hirst that's made him so important? And how do you figure he's managed to be such a star in the art world?
Redefining the art student, that's an important thing. I mean, he's got a way of redefining. Those are pretty interesting. He's got to make some art somewhere along the line or get somebody to do it somewhere along the line. But it's the brashness, a lot with him that seems to me to be the most interesting thing. There are other people, and he's in a complex situation, the art world, and there are a lot of people who are thinking all the time. If there weren't an art world, there wouldn't be art. That's the way I think about it. So, but when you put together everything, and that some of the most interesting minds in America are doing this kind of thing, or in Great Britain, then you realize that it's not just Damien. It's the art world and what the art world thinks, and the willingness of the people who buy things to buy that kind of thing and say, where till I show you my Damien Hirst? And that's how it works.
Damien Hirst has often been criticized for the fact that much of his work he actually has no direct hand in. For instance, his spot paintings, of which he's created around 1,000. He's perhaps only painted a dozen and left the rest of the work up to his assistants. And yet these works still sell for hundreds of thousands of dollars. As a critic, do you take issue with the fact that much of Hirst's work is in fact done by his assistants? Or do you think it's all about the idea and sort of the concept of what his work embodies?
I think that's the main thing, is the idea. I mean, when I was writing criticism, what I was mainly concerned with was, what's it about? And then, how do you know what it's about? And that means, how is an idea embodied in that object? And then, was it worth doing? And, I mean, that's where a certain amount of judgment comes in. But that if you don't have the idea, you don't have anything.
That was art critic Arthur Danto speaking with our man, Barrett Austin. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're back with an art market take on Mr. Hirst just after this.
For the latest Monocle news, previews on upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop of all of our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're having a bit of a splash on Damien Hirst as we prepare ourselves for this week's opening party at Tate Modern. So what's the market attitude to the one-time boy wonder? Still all rosy in the garden? To find out, we spoke to art advisor Lisa Schiff. Lisa, I wanted to start off by asking you about how bulletproof the market for Damien Hirsts are. We always kind of think that they're a kind of solid gold investment. Is this still the case?
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, when we think about art history, we think about canons of artists. You know, if an artist makes it into the canon, they're in the history books. I think there's also a market canon, and I think Damien Hirst has proved himself there. And I think, you know, like Warhol or Koons, his market will go down when the general market goes down, but it'll always come back up. So it's what we call recession-proof.
After the Sotheby's sale in 2008, You possibly could have said that there was a lack of goodwill towards Damien Hirst because it made so many headlines for the amount of cash, and it was obviously the day that the Lehman Brothers crisis hit. With a big show like this Tate retrospective or Tate survey show, does this sort of put a good injection of goodwill into an artist's back catalogue?
I think so. You know, it gives us a minute to stop and really historicize him. And I think, you know, when you really sit down with the books and you read about him and you read what he did and where he started, it's pretty fascinating. It's pretty magnificent. And what he did with the auction, I think it was just scary because it was a change in the structure that, you know, could potentially hurt galleries, right? It's like, it's sort of undermining the gallery system and going to like what we all look at as the grossest possible thing, you know, go right to auction from the studio. But again, I mean, this is part of his work, and in a weird way, this performance of the market and this sort of reconfiguration of the artist doesn't have to be the poor guy sitting alone in his studio. He can be an entrepreneur, a businessman, he can be a capitalist, you know, and it's, you know, this is the place where art is so fascinating, where money and aesthetics collide. It always has been. It's always so confusing. And, you know, I think he's just sort of turned this notion of what the artist has always been on its head. Warhol started to, but Damien really took it to the next level. Like, he's incredibly wealthy. And it's funny that we want to disdain him for that.
It was an interesting thing I was going to ask you about that. It seems like Damien Hirst sort of changed people's perception of what an artist could be, that they didn't have to be a kind of a skinny, starving person in a garret, you know, that they could be a kind of rock star. Do you think the fact that, you know, any, you know, New York or London taxi driver or any taxi driver around the world will probably have a point of view on Damien Hirst, do you think that adds to his value as an artist, market and art historical-wise, or sort of takes away from it, the fact that he's not, people perhaps regard him as unsubtle?
I think it's amazing. I think, yes, taxi drivers know who he is. They'll have an opinion on him. I think the avant-garde, you know, since the modernization of the world, has always been, you know, one of the more important political aspects of aesthetics is to make visible things that we cannot see sometimes if we're just looking at a political angle. And Damien has sort of brought to the forefront this sort of capitalist structure which underlies all of our lives. Not that we don't see it, I mean, it's glaring at us, but he's sort of really, I think, you know, when you take art history classes, everything, every theoretical angle, every philosopher, it's always from a left-wing Marxist perspective. And, you know, it's sort of bad to look at art as a money thing. And I think he's saying it's not bad.
Just finally, there was an editorial in the British newspapers earlier this week, someone was saying that, you know, that if you have a Damien Hirst, sell it now because, you know, his stock will never be higher and he'll fall off a cliff after this show's finished. Is that just sort of someone trying to get their name in the newspaper list, or is there any sort of truth in that?
I mean, people have been saying that Damien's going to fall off a cliff forever. I mean, it's not the first time someone said that, and I just don't think he will. I think he's canonized into the market, and it'll go up and it'll go down. But, you know, for me, the obvious thing is you don't buy a Damien Hirst spot painting when there's a worldwide show at Gagosian. That's not the time to buy. You buy, you know, a couple of years after the show when things quiet down a little bit. Again, I think he will ebb and flow. You know, he'll rise with the tides and go down with them as well.
That was art analyst Lisa Schiff talking to me from Paris. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. This is another song from our album of the week from Bahamas. This is Lost in the Light.
I'm lost in the light. I pray for the night to take me to. After so many words, still nothing's heard. Don't know what we should do.
And that is lovely. That's called Lost in the Light, new from Bahamas, and the album is called Bahamas as well, and that is our record of the week. Now, continuing our theme of great British artists, I was frankly honoured to meet Sir Peter Blake last week. Among a huge raft of other things, Blake has often associated commonly with his cover art for the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band album. As a celebration of his 80th birthday, Sir Peter has just created a new piece of artwork inspired by this iconic album cover, which will be on display at his pal Wayne Hemingway's Vintage Festival this July in Northamptonshire. I met up with him to talk about his impressive career. I wanted to kick off by obviously asking you about this reimagining of that famous album cover. You get to put your heroes in this piece.
Yeah.
maybe you can tell us about a couple of them, and you know who you decided to put in.
Well, they're all either British or working in Great Britain. Some have died, some are dead. We replaced the drum with a target, and on the target it says that it's my birthday. It's family, friends, and idols. So it's my immediate family. So it's my wife and my three daughters. And then it's friends, and then sometimes a crossover that the friend is also someone that's an idol. You know, so there are some actors, there are quite a lot of musicians, there are quite a lot of people from the food industry. You know, there are a few chefs, a few restaurateurs.
People that have kept you in rude health for 80 years.
People
then
have become friends. You know, like Chris Corbin and Jeremy King, and like Mark Hicks. You know, they're on there. John Hurt is on there as an actor that I admire very much. There's some other artists. Lucian Freud is on there. Damien Hirst, Tracy Emin, Gavin Turk. Again, it was a list that could have gone on indefinitely. I mean, probably the next person would have been Gary Hume, and it would have gone on from there, you know. But,
it's a bit like who do you invite to your wedding or something, isn't it?
It's difficult.
It has to end somewhere.
Yeah, but there has to be a cut-off point, so it includes some.
And I wanted to ask you about, you know, Damien Hirst and Tracy Emin's work as well. You've name checked them before in interviews and things, yeah, as a couple of people that you've never said this, but whose work might not have taken the route it took if it weren't for some of the stuff that you did back then. And looking back over 80 years, it must be nice to, in pictorial form, to gather some of your friends around you for this 80th picture.
We were talking earlier today, there seems to be a kind of Damien Hirst backlash, that there suddenly seems to be a crowd of vultures gathering above him and attacking him. And I think it's completely unfair. You know, if the question was, what do I think about those artists? I think Damien adds an enormous amount to the kind of the colour and the excitement of the art world. And I think he's a brilliant artist. And I think the mistake that people make is thinking he's a greedy young man. You know, it's about making money. Whereas the point is that the subject matter is money. I mean, his work is about, it's about wealth. I mean, he's commenting on wealth. And in fact, people wouldn't know how actually generous he is to charities. I know exactly you some of the money he's given, which is amazing. But people think he's only interested in making money, which he isn't.
I was down in Bath. I went to see the show that was down there, the Museum for Myself, I think it was called. And the idea of collecting things, categorising things, you know, displaying them as works of art when they might not be, or they might not be considered to be, that's a big part of the stuff that you've done. And lots of people do that nowadays. Is that fair to say?
Well, it's been part of my work process. I mean, collecting has been very much part of it. But, I mean, until relatively recently, it was a private thing. It wasn't, it just was part of the way I worked, you know, that some of the stuff was collected to make art with and some was collected for the sake of collecting. I showed it as a collection, I suppose it's about 10 years ago now, at the Morley Gallery, and then 2 years ago showed it as the Museum of Everything. James Brett showed his collection, the first Museum of Everything number one, and then I was the Museum of Everything number two, and that was my collection, and I curated that with James. And then the extension of that was the Museum for Myself, which is based on a large collage I made called Museum for Myself, where I kept objects which might have gone into collages, but I wanted to keep. You know? So, I mean, I had an autograph by Marcel Duchamp and an autograph by the Talking Heads and stuff that I wanted to keep but also used. So it was based on that. So that was the collection, but relating to the work as well. So there were circus objects that I collect, but there were also the wood engravings I did called Sideshow of Circus Figures. So it linked the collection to the work.
And where does it all go? Because obviously this collage thing for Sgt. Pepper's record cover, 45 years ago, and then for your new piece for your 80th birthday this year is for Vintage. That's all a collage thing. It's a collection of things you like and presumably, massed onto one page. Has that always sort of informed how you work? Can you not sort of help doing that, picking stuff up?
Yeah, I mean, another thing I've just finished is I've done two or three portfolios. They're made as collages but become prints, and I did one of images about Paris and then images about Venice. Now, Venice first, then Paris. And I've just done a London portfolio of 10 prints. And that becomes a way of telling the story. I mean, my work is often about storytelling and inventing scenarios and things happening and changing and an ongoing story. I mean, I've just decided, for instance, that there's usually been an alter ego. You know, I did a series of things about Marcel Duchamp called Marcel Duchamp's World Tour, where I sent Marcel Duchamp as a thank you for saying the statement he made that if an artist makes something, therefore it's art. I mean, it's a very simple statement, but it covers a lot of ground, and it gave a lot of us the carte blanche to do what we do. He opened a door which we could all go through. And so I sent him on this world tour where he met all the sideshow people from Barnum and Bailey's circus. He played chess with Tracy. He went to a party. He met the Spice Girls and Elvis at the same time. This was storytelling, and I've now decided that there'll be a whole series of work called autobiography, where I'll become my own alter ego. So I'll take a series of photographs, and I'll be the everyman or whatever this figure is within the picture. So I'm about to go on my own world tour. So,
and where are you going on your world tour? Have you used up a couple of your heroes for Marcel already?
The same places. I mean, there's a couple of the collages have been. I did a collage called a Convention of Comic Book Characters. You know, I cut out Mickey Mouse and Superman. The first one happened to take place. I bought a book of photographs of Vichy in France. There were just three beautiful photographs. So the first one took place in a kind of hall in Vichy. And then, as part of the London series, there's one called The Comic Book Character Convention Comes to London. So I think there may well be a third convention that I go to. So,
the alternative Peter Blake, who goes on his world tour.
It'll be me treating myself, you know.
The idea of meeting Mickey Mouse and these other icons and the rest of it, a lot of your work throughout your career has been about iconography, and lots of characters have turned up again, like Elvis, who you sent off Marcel Duchamp to meet and all the rest of it.
The Butterfly Man is an ongoing character. Yeah. I found a little engraving. He's in fact a conductor. It's a really old wood engraving of a conductor holding a stick, and that became the kind of vehicle for a butterfly to sit on. There have been a whole series about him and his trained butterflies. I mean, in one of them, there's a formation of butterflies flying across like the red arrows that he's trained to do that. In the London series, there's a specialist act called the Duo Peacock, which is two peacock butterflies performing, and hundreds of other butterflies, but they're the speciality act. So characters like that will appear again.
And a couple of these images have cropped up on a couple of the other album covers you've done, the other artwork you've done for people like Paul Weller and Oasis. And you said that also you wanted your art to sort of aspire to the form of pop music, or to be as understandable as pop music for people. After 80 years, you must be able to tell us how that's been a success or not.
Well, curiously, it struck me almost like a bolt of lightning that at the Brit Awards this year, I designed the actual award. They redesigned it 2 years ago, and Vivienne Westwood did it the first year, and they use a different artist each year, to kind of decorate, I suppose, this existing Britannia figure. And I didn't do the sets, but they were designed around my work, so there were lots of stars and hearts and things. And I suddenly thought, what I was talking about in 1955, what my intentions were and what I was striving to do, and didn't happen. I mean, the language, the intention was that I made an art that was the equivalent of music, and you read it in the same way, and I didn't achieve it. But suddenly at the Brit Awards, there I was, and suddenly it happened, so it did happen.
And that was Sir Peter Blake. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. We're off to Moscow after this.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle also has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. Then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop, carefully crafted design proud of its provenance.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. From April the 5th, Russian cinema goers will be able to see a unique film drawn from a unique concert born of one man, Yuri Shevchuk, the lead singer and, for 30 years, heart and soul of Russian rock group DDT, as Peter Van Dyke now reports from Moscow.
Hello, my friend, jokes Yuri Shevchuk. I will tell you a fairy tale about how you can live another way.
Добрым, нежным, мягким, соответствующим, аутентичным.
You can be a person, good, tender, responsible, authentic. For many Russians, Yuri Shevchuk is that person. He has been singing of freedom and human dignity since the 80s, when his band, DDT, was one of the giants of Soviet rock.
Shevchuk stood out among the crowd because he was primarily a poet.
Vladimir Kozlov is an author and writer about the arts.
He was able to speak about all those social and political issues in the country in a language that was understood by tens of thousands of people.
Those old songs include Rodina, Motherland. When Shevchuk started to sing the 80s anthem at the end of an opposition protest this February, it took just seconds for the crowd to join in. The bittersweet ode to a flawed but loved country rings true with the protesters, and Shevchuk's determined and constant calls for human dignity and freedom resonate with them too. That's why he remains an important figure, says Kozlov.
Unlike many other Soviet rock musicians of that time, he has preserved a lot of edge, and he's still socially and politically active because he's the most outspoken rock musician of that generation.
Now, DDT's music has changed, as has the lineup. But Shevchuk still sings of a better world. The latest album and the concert tour that was filmed is called Inache, Otherwise. In Southwesterly Wind, he tells us that tomorrow everything will be Inache. Otherwise, different. Shevchuk is now, again, far more than just a musician, says music critic Boris Barabanov.
It's so important person for Russia now. He carries a huge weight of, you know, it's not only protest moving, it's just the idea of a person in Russia. A man standing on his place.
Barabanov complains that the film, Nebo pod Sertsum, Like Heaven in the Heart, is little more than a concert DVD.
For this moment, Yuri is much more important than this film shows.
But Shevchuk still puts his music first. That's why he didn't appear at an opposition protest rally until February. Earlier gatherings clashed with his concerts. And that's what drove director Victoria Kaskova to make the film about his music, not his activism.
As soon as we made ourselves closer to him, we realized that actually the music and the show he produced is something very, very important for him, much more important than what he does apart from the concert. And then we realized that if we really would like to talk, to tell people about his personality, we need to talk through his songs and through his work on the show. Because if you listen to the words, if you listen to his poetry, you realize that these are the messages, these are the most important things.
My songs are my politics, Shevchuk explains when the cameras follow him to a radio station. The songs he is talking about have names like Novaya Rossiya, A New Russia, and Pesnya o Svobodye, Song About Freedom. Freedom, freedom, Shevchuk sings, such a lot, such a little. There is a difference between economic freedom and civil liberties.
He says that consumerism won here. We can buy all we need. The salaries are okay. The pensions will be okay. It's over.
Barabanov says Shevchuk's lyrics were more resonant as the Soviet Union fell apart before Russia began to get a middle class again.
He understands that in the end of 80s, beginning of 90s, he was much more influential person than now, because he was really voice of a generation. But now, in the generation that has everything, actually, doesn't need the voice like this. And that's his problem, that he's trying to find the new language for this situation, for these days.
The album Inache is part of that struggle. It is a long way from DDT's 80s sound, and the Soviet Union perished long before many of the crowd at the concert were born. But this concert and this film is about more than the music. A giant 70-foot screen behind the stage shows video art accompanying each song.
The visual concept of the concert gave us additional layer in our film. And maybe it was quite challenging for me as a director because, to add another layer to another layer to another layer could be quite tricky.
The song Vstrecha, Meeting, is backed by a huge apartment block. It could hardly look more Russian. The sun rises against it and then the camera pans up, lifting the audience up into the clouds. Kaskova hopes the film will give more Russians the chance to witness this epic concert on a cinematic scale. Fans of Shevchuk's music may well be satisfied. Supporters of his activism could be left wanting more. Director Kaskova and critic Barabanov may well agree that that is something for an altogether different film. For Monocle in Moscow, I'm Peter Van Dijk.
So we've run out of time again for this week. Next week, we'll finally be visiting Brazil to find out what they're doing right in the land of culture. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. My producer was Katie Bilboa, helped by Hannah Jenkins, and the editing heavyweight, Holly Fisher. Time for one final song this week from our album of the week, Bahamas, by Bahamas. This is I Got You, Babe. Thanks for tuning in.
Standing tall, I sing.